Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. We have a lot going on the program today. We're going to when we come back from this traffic break, we're going to hear a series of conversations that we had with people about the Gaza Peace Flotilla. One of those people we're going to hear from is Heber Brown, the Reverend Heber Brown from here in Baltimore, Maryland, who was in the Holy Land when this happened. We're going to hear from a number of other people. Then we're going to talk to Adam Shapiro, who is one of the organizers of the Gaza Peace Flotilla. We're going to talk to a number of people at the top of the next hour about the violence in Baltimore, including Len Smith, who co-chairs Love Hands Across Baltimore Crusade. And then we have our monthly visit from Woody Curry to talk about all manner of things to do with addiction and more. So stay with us for all that. But first, let's take you over to WEAA traffic, and we'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by REI. More information at REI.com.
I'm Mark Steiner. As we continue our discussions about what happened in the Mediterranean with the Israeli Navy attacking the Gaza Peace Flotilla, on Sunday I received a Facebook message from the Reverend Heber Brown, who's been a guest on the show many times and is a well-known activist in this community for peace and social justice. And he is in the Middle East, it turned out. So, Heber Brown, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Mark. Mark, I appreciate the opportunity.
So tell me, what are you doing in the Middle East right now?
I'm here with a delegation called the Interfaith Peace Builders, and we're in this delegation in cooperation with the National Peace Foundation, a delegation of about 30 people, most of us from the States. We have people from Singapore and other places. We're here just to learn more about the situation that's going on here in Palestine, Israel. We're here to meet with people from many sides of the various issues that are present here, and it's been a truly eye-opening experience.
Well, talk about what has happened. I want to hear more about this group before we end the conversation, but tell me, when you wrote me, you wrote saying that what you're learning on the streets of Israel and Palestine now after this attack on the flotilla by the Israeli Navy was pretty eye-opening. Talk about what's been going on.
Well, we had been watching and following the news as it related to the Freedom Flotilla. We were excited when we learned that it was on the way to provide aid, and we were doubly excited to know that we would be here when it was scheduled to arrive. So you can imagine then, after following news on the Freedom Flotilla for many days since we've been here, we woke up a couple mornings ago, and we were told at breakfast that had been attacked by the Israeli Navy. We were disgusted, heartbroken, and saddened, of course, for the lives that are lost and for the 1.5 million people who are Gaza Strip, the blockade by the Israeli military.
So tell me, go ahead, I'm sorry, finish what you're saying.
On the ground is a lot of hope and expectation and of course, goodwill and prayer about 10,000 tons of humanitarian aid being delivered, because group had been just a day before, maybe a couple of days ago, we were at the Gaza Strip, Mark. I was actually standing, of course, outside the concrete walls. 1.5 million Palestinians are behind concrete walls, and the Israeli military decides who comes in and who comes out. It's a very restrictive and repressive operation that's going on there. We were even turned away by the Israeli military when we just wanted to kind of get closer and learn more. And so on the ground here, there's a lot of outrage. Of course, the Israeli government has issued a blackout on information. And so even here, while we're here in Palestine, Israel, we are stretching and reaching, trying to get more information about those who have been killed and injured and about the humanitarian aid and what's going to happen with that. But on the ground here, because the government has really just instituted a crackdown on releasing any information, we're going through other channels to try to get as much information as we can. For people who are listening to my voice right now back in the States, just a week and a half ago, I was right in Baltimore with you. And since being here, I remember that hearing about the Middle East can be so foreign and can seem so far away. Like, I got to confess, there's something strangely familiar about this place. And as an African American, I believe that my radar as it relates to discrimination is particularly sharp. And being here for a week and a half, I can say with no hesitation, racial, ethnic, and religious discrimination is a matter of official government policy here. Let me give you some examples. Segregated roads. Some roads that railies can drive on, which are better and paved and nice. And there are other roads that Palestinians have to drive on. They cannot drive on the Israeli roads. There are two set of laws here, Mark. One set of laws for Israelis. There's a different set of laws for Palestinians. There are separate educational facilities. I have been confronted a number of times by Israeli defense forces, and I was warned before even coming that as a person of color that might be a possibility, and it has turned into a reality here since I've been here. I've had a number of encounters. I'm the only African-American particular delegation, and I've been multiple times. I've been asked, why am I here? Who am I? By Israeli defense forces who walk around here with automatic weapons all over the place. And so it's a particularly, while it seemed foreign before I came, very familiar now that I'm here.
So you feel because you're an African-American, you've been singled out?
Well, yeah, and that's only a small piece. I mean, they are religious, racial, and ethnic discrimination that is a regular part of reality here for many, many, many people. I'm just sharing just what I've seen and what I've directly experienced. And because of our history in the United States and because of the history of African-American people there and my personal experiences there, I know discrimination, I see it. I know Arabic, may not know Hebrew. I'm still trying to learn all the different names of the places. But, Mark, when I know discrimination when I see it and when I feel it. And it's all over here. And I know this is shocking to a lot of people, what I'm saying, because the American media does not, by and large, hear this perspective. And I just believe what I saw on the mainstream media outlets back home. On the ground, totally different story. And I know if more Americans knew and could see what I'm seeing right now, we would together be up in arms and say, no, this cannot happen. You cannot discriminate based on race, religion, ethnicity anywhere in the world. And our tax dollars are supporting it. That's the crazy thing. Now, our tax dollars helped the massacre to happen. Our tax dollars are helping discrimination to continue in this state, and we don't even know it.
The Reverend Heber Brown talking to us live now from the Holy Land. Heber, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We are now talking to Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, who joins us from Istanbul. Phyllis, good to talk to you once again.
Good to be with you, Mark.
Talk a bit about the statement you released and your kind of analysis and thoughts about what occurred.
Well, I think this is one more piece of evidence, if anyone needed additional evidence, that Israel has decided that it's better to be perceived as savage than to be perceived as being weak. That was really a very conscious decision that the Israelis made. They knew that the boats were carrying humanitarian goods and human rights activists. They knew the boats were unarmed civilians. The boats, the passengers, the cargo had all been checked thoroughly by governments before leaving from Turkey, before leaving from Cyprus. So this was not an issue of they thought that they were going to be smuggling in weapons. In fact, one of the outrageous statements from one Israeli official was, we haven't seen evidence that there were missiles being smuggled to Hamas in Gaza. Well, of course there was no evidence of it. They knew that. That was never an issue. This was a political point that was being made. And the price for that political point was the death of, so far we don't know for sure how many people have been killed. We don't know their names. We don't know the condition of those who were injured. We don't know what's happening to all the hundreds of people that have been imprisoned by the Israelis. So this is an act of what would be piracy if it wasn't done under a national flag. This was a piracy-like, a piracy-style attack in international waters, something that Israel isn't even disputing. They're not even claiming that they were in Israeli territorial waters. They were apparently somewhere between 40 and 50 miles off the Gaza coast, something which Israel has no right to be imposing a blockade on. This was similar to the arguments that we heard from the George Bush administration about the, quote, right, a preventive right to go to war against Iraq because Iraq might have weapons of mass destruction that they might give to somebody who might use them against a country we like or maybe would use them someday in the future if they ever built one. And, oh, P.S., well, it turns out they didn't have weapons at all, but we had the right. It's that kind of a right to besiege the Gaza Strip and to besiege and attack pirate style these ships in international water that Israel has claimed.
What do you think is going to be the consequence of all this? I mean, we know the other ships now are moving still towards Gaza. Hosni Mubarak has opened up the border, at least for the moment, between Egypt and Gaza.
Certainly the opening of the border between Egypt and Gaza will be very important in alleviating the immediate humanitarian crisis of today. But until the siege is lifted, until free Gaza becomes a reality, that temporary easing is not an answer. You know, allowing a few more items on the approved list of goods that Israel allows in to make sure that the people of Gaza don't starve to death. There was, for example, an Israeli document that was leaked a few days ago that identified the so-called red lines of Palestinian nutritional needs in Gaza, that basically was making sure that a certain number of minimum calories per day, per Gazan, was available in the Strip so that Israel could not be accused of starving people to death. That, to me, it's a travesty. I mean, the fact that you're going to determine how many calories people can live on, even if those calories are made up solely of bread and oil, and not allow school books, not allow freedom to come and to go, for visitors to come and to leave. So this is not an answer. But what is clearly going to be different now is the diplomatic responses to this is profoundly changing the political realities. Right now, the Gaza Freedom Movement, the flotilla, is an example of civil society taking the initiative because governments have failed. Governments have failed to break the siege against Gaza. Governments have failed to protect the people of Palestine living under occupation in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. So civil society has moved in to take responsibility for that. I think that the results of this horrific massacre is going to be quite substantial, quite profound, and I think there is a chance something good could come out of this horror. We are already seeing an increased isolation of Israeli diplomatic normality as a result of this attack. All of the members of the Security Council were outraged and expressed their outrage over this attack, despite the fact that U.S. pressure prevented the Council from actually passing a strong resolution. In NATO, every NATO country so far, except for the United States itself, is acknowledging in some language or other that it was a civilian ship that belonged to a NATO member state, Turkey, an important NATO member state, that was wantonly attacked in international waters. So that's going to increase significantly, I think, the pressure to redefine NATO's relationship with Israel. The relationships between Israel and the European Union is now, I think, going to be significantly changed. And we are now hearing from the head of the Israeli Mossad, the Israeli version of the CIA, that he is now concerned that Israel is becoming a liability for the United States rather than an asset. And clearly he understands that that means the danger is, from the Israeli vantage point, that the U.S. will change and reduce its willingness to provide uncritical and unlimited political, military, economic, diplomatic, and financial support to Israel, regardless of the violations of its policies.
As this ship was announced heading back towards Gaza, a ship heading toward Gaza, an Israeli military officer said that the last time we went in and were surprised, but this time we know it's war and we're going to go in prepared for war. I'm very interested. Be very interested to see what you think, what others think about what's going to happen internally inside of Israel. But that debate will a debate erupt inside Israel about the future of all of this?
It's a very good question, Mark, and I frankly don't know. So far, Israelis have not shown themselves to be outraged by anything that their government and their military has done, including the assault on Gaza a year and a half ago that led to the killing of 1,400 Gazans, of whom 950 or more were civilians, about 300 were women, about 180 were children, and there was completely insufficient outrage among Israelis. Of course, there are some brave Israelis, many of them friends of mine, who are desperately trying to build opposition to this kind of behavior, but they are a tiny minority. What we're hearing about is that there were Israeli crowds cheering the IDF from a hill overlooking Ashdod, overlooking the the port when the ships were towed in under arms, cheering on their government and congratulating them and being grateful and glad that this had happened. So I'm not looking to that. I am looking to, again, civil society, Palestinian civil society, those brave parts of Israeli civil society, the human rights organizations in particular, that are going to have to play this role. Governments are certainly not going to do it. But I think that what's key is that this is going to cause a shift in the discourse dramatically in the rest of the world. And the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, which is the initiative of civil society, both globally and within Palestinian civil society, to bring nonviolent economic pressure to bear on Israel to stop these violations, that's what we're seeing having a real impact, and I think that's going to continue.
Phyllis Bennis, I appreciate you taking the time and your busy day to do this with us, and we look forward to talking to you very soon when you get back to the States.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. We're about to have a conversation with Ori Ner, who is the Americans for Peace Now spokesman. He was a former Washington correspondent for Haaretz, one of Israel's largest newspapers, kind of known as the New York Times of Israel. And then he worked for the Forwards, which was a longstanding Jewish neighborhood here in the United States. And Ori Ner, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Tell me, let's just start with what the Peace Now's reaction to all this is.
Well, Americans for Peace Now immediately reacted with shock and with dismay at the outcome of this encounter in the Mediterranean. The regardless of what the actual operational details of Israel's raid on these ships were, we feel that the outcome that the death of innocent civilians on board was unacceptable.
But tell me, as someone who's followed this Israel forever and is an Israeli, and I'm just curious, really want to hear your perspective on what you think the dynamic is going on here.
Look, operationally, it's not yet clear. I think I more or less gather what happened there operationally. Our emphasis, however, I think, should be more on the policy of the siege on Gaza, and I'm sure we'll get to it in a moment.
Yes, yes.
In terms of the operation here, what I think happened was the following: 5 of the 6 flotilla ships were taken over by the Israeli commandos easily. They came down from a helicopter and just took over the ship without resistance. The 6th ship, however, the largest one, was a different case. And on that ship, if I understand correctly, there were some radical activists who decided to resist. And their resistance apparently was violent resistance, and they used some object in order to beat the soldiers as they landed on the ship. Operationally, and this is something that, again, I'm not an expert. I'm looking at the Israeli press and reading the analysis in the Israeli media of experts on this issue, and everyone agrees. There's a complete consensus among the pundits that this was carried out wrong, in the wrong fashion, because when you deal with crowd control, and there should have been at least a contingency plan of how you deal with an angry crowd on the board of the ship, the approach should be massive power. There should be a wall of law enforcement officers. And here, instead of that, the soldiers were dropped one by one on a rope from the helicopter, and one by one they were taken and beaten up. That's an unacceptable method. And that's something that now the Israeli military is being criticized very, very, very critically inside Israeli society. But again, the details of the operation and the failure in terms of intelligence and in terms of expecting or preparing for the worst and so on, I think really should not become the center of the conversation. What should be the center of the conversation is the broader context of the siege of Gaza, which is a policy that really has now become bankrupt. It has failed, and the untenable situation of Israel's ongoing occupation, its ongoing attempt to accommodate a situation of not having peace with its Arab neighbors.
I'm very curious about your analysis of what's happening internally inside of Israel. What do you think right now are the tensions going on inside of Israeli society?
If you look at it through Israeli eyes, what Israelis saw here is a humiliating moment where commandos, very respectable, well-trained commandos, are being dropped into a trap of people waiting for them with metal bars and hitting them. That's a very humiliating scene, as some of your listeners may have seen these videos. If you look at it from Israeli eyes, it's very humiliating, and the first reaction you have is to really feel bad for the soldiers and to rally around them. What we've seen in the past is that there's a second phase, and I think we're already there, beginning to be there, if you look at the Israeli media today, of soul-searching and saying, hey, wait a minute, how did it happen that we got into this kind of situation? So first, there's a focus on really short-term decision-making processes, on issues that have to do with the operational level, who gave the order, and so on and so forth. And then there's a third phase where people look at the broader context and say, how did we, in the first place, get into a situation where we have to, where we are stopping humanitarian aid ships on their way to Gaza to deliver toys and food to children? How does that jibe with the way we want to see ourselves? And that, I think, will come, I very much hope will come, although not in the proportion that I'd like to see. But I think that that will come in the next phase, maybe in the next few days or weeks.
And very quickly, Ori, before we have to move on, if this thing escalates worldwide and the movement to boycott Israel and to not allow artists to come in and to, much as like happened in South Africa before the end of apartheid, that could cause a lot of rift and tension, not just in the world between Israel and the rest of the world, but also within those who support the rights of Palestinians to have their own state and are looking for peace on all sides here. This could also have an incredible fission take place inside of that movement as well.
That's correct, which is why we're dealing with this issue in a very, very sensitive manner. We don't support boycott and divestment from Israel. We think that it's actually counterproductive. We look at it from the perspective of efficacy, not so much the issue of justice and so on. Although, of course, we don't. Don't get me wrong. We very much value these issues, but just from the perspective of efficacy, of how that can work and what kind of impact it would have on Israeli society, and on the kind of pressure that one would want to see from the grassroots up, from Israeli society to the leadership, we believe that boycott and divestment would actually have the opposite impact, a kind of a backlash, where Israelis would rally around the more radical or more hardline positions of their government.
Well, Neil, I do appreciate you taking the time with us today, and we look forward to, in the coming weeks, to having a good colloquium on the air between activists to how we respond to all this. And I want to thank you for taking time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ori. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm glad you're listening to our program today. We're about to come back live with a discussion with Adam Shapiro and then David Makovsky about what's going on in the Mediterranean with the Gulf Peace Flotilla. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Division of Transplantation, where patients' lives are enhanced by a renowned transplant program known for innovation and excellence in kidney, liver, and pancreas transplants. For more information, you can call 1-800-492-5538. And we continue our discussion about what is going on with the Gaza Peace Flotilla. We've heard from a number of people who were there, who were in Israel and in Palestine, as well as in Istanbul and here in the States. And we are going to be joined a little bit by Adam Shapiro, one of the organizers of the flotilla, who is bringing the supplies to Gaza. His wife was on board one of the boats, was taken prisoner, I understand, by the Israeli army, and has just been released just a little bit ago, and he should be joining us by phone. And we are also joined by David Makovsky, director of the project of the on the Middle East peace process at the Washington Institute for Near East Studies, and co-author with Dennis Ross of the book Myths, Illusions, and Peace: Finding a New Direction in the Middle East, recently released in paperback with a new afterword. And ask you all to join us here at 410-319-8888. David, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be with you.
So tell us a bit about your perspective on this. We've heard a great deal from a lot of people who are involved, not with the flotilla directly, but who have, from people from Peace Now and Orionier and others. And before I ask any specific questions, I'm just curious about what your perspective is on the whole issue.
Well, first of all, what happened was a tragedy, and any loss of life should be regretted. The issue is, where do you go with it, and where do we go forward? And I think it's important for your listeners just to understand, the origins of this whole issue. It started really in 2005. Israel thought it was getting out of Gaza, and people said, if you don't occupy land, you're more secure, you're not more vulnerable. And that was the advice Israel took. But since it left, it has been the target of 3,300 attacks between then and the opening of the Gaza war. Rocket attacks, that is, 3,300 rockets, and it made its border towns uninhabitable. The ranges kept going more and more. It met up to 27 kilometers. Israeli cities were in sights. These were not just homemade rockets. These are things that came from Iran, Grodmat rockets, and also what they call the Fajr 3 rocket. So at a certain point, Israel felt it had to retaliate. But what's had a lasting impact is that people said, well, if you didn't like the book in Gaza, why would you see the movie in the West Bank? And therefore, this issue has had a lingering legacy, is that it's making now peace talks much harder. So it's hard to tell the Israelis, trust Hamas, they won't do it again, when they don't accept Israel the size of a telephone booth on a Tel Aviv beach. So this is what has complicated the issue. Now, could the blockade be recalibrated in a certain way to minimize some pain? I think is a fair question, but it just seems a bit odd to me that the peace activists, I don't know Adam Shapiro personally, but that these are people on the side of an organization that exhort for suicide bombing that has had homicidal impact. 1,000 Israelis have been killed by it, that have adorned the pictures of the bombers on walls. And I would think, do it something much simpler. Those very simple. Press Hamas to accept Israel and agree to the international conditions. These are not Israeli conditions or American conditions. This is the U.S., the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations. And that has been the terms, and that's been President Obama's terms, and he's reaffirmed it time after time. So this thing could all be done within a day if, these activists would use that same sort of pressure on Hamas and to lift that embargo. But it's all been driven, really, I think, for more defensive purposes and not punitive ones.
Well, I a couple of questions, I suppose, as we wait for Adam and some others to join us in. Our listeners, please join us here at 410-319-8888. We've heard the Reverend Heber Brown, Phyllis Bennis, and Ori Neer, and we're now joined by David Makovsky. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation about what has been happening in the Mediterranean with the what is known as the Gazan Peace Flotilla. A couple of direct questions and kind of general questions. I think this is a very complex question, and in the sense of where this may lead Israel and the United States and the world in the coming months. I mean, let's just start with a lot of the arguments, even from most of the Israeli press that I read today, from Haaretz, from the Post, from any number of papers, which was this was a at best, I think people in Haaretz would talk about, a boneheaded move by the Israeli government to attack the flotilla, to land soldiers in, that there were a lot of other responses that could have been taken. And that this is also, this is a nightmare for Israel in terms of PR, but it, and at worst, it was an action that has inflamed, I think, a good portion of the world against to further their angst about Israel.
Look, I'm not here to, you know, I mean, we can get into the narrow tactical question, could they have done it this way versus that way. I was trying to hit the broader issue, which is, where do we go from here? The UN Security Council had a presidential statement this morning, early this morning, which did not blame Israel and which did not call for an independent commission of inquiry, but just said there should be some impartial, transparent way to look into the incident at hand. And I think that's a good idea. And I think that's been President Obama's position as well. So I hope that, you know, this that there is some inquiry into, you know, the tactics and everything surrounding the incident. But I'm trying to say, where does this story go? If I had to kind of project it forward, is the question of, you know, is the blockade of Gaza advisable in the broad sense? And clearly, you know, this should end tomorrow. But it takes two to tango, is to get Hamas to say they want to live in peace. And I think the Israelis would lift it. That would be a profoundly transformative event. But you know they're not going to do that. And yet we somehow excuse that and say, well, we don't expect Hamas to act. You know, we're going to put all the onus on the Israelis. And I just think in the broad sense that that doesn't make any sense when there's a clear history here of 3,300 rockets being fired at Israeli towns after they withdrew from occupied territory.
I mean, but we can always. I mean, the whole idea of who's done what first and to whom is been part of the problem in the Middle East to begin with. And all the years I've been covering it, it's always been part of the problem. I mean, if there wasn't,
I disagree with you, sir. Respectfully, I disagree because I think what happened in 2005 was a profound event. The whole world was riveted on this whole idea that Ariel Sharon, who was viewed as the patron of the settlers, you know, suddenly picked up 8,000 settlers, uprooted them from their homes, and left Gaza. That was a big event. It wasn't just who goes first here. And the hope was that, you know, by Israel getting out of occupied territory, Israel would be more secure and not more vulnerable. And people said, yeah, but the Israelis still have ways to control from the air and the sea. But the fact was, where it counted was the Gaza-Egypt border, because that's where all the rockets have come in. And the Israelis abandoned it because they believed the international community and radio talk show hosts and others who said, well, if you only don't occupy people, you'll be safer. You won't be more vulnerable. They took your advice, and look what happened. This is not a little bump in the road, sir. This is a big deal. And we're living in the shadow of that. And if you're George Mitchell, now you have a much harder job in the West Bank because of that. And well, that is a profound turning point in this crisis. And to ignore it and just say, well, we don't want to say who did what in the past, I think that's really misleading the viewers.
Well, except that you have a situation where
the listeners. Sorry.
Pardon?
The listeners, not the viewers.
Listeners, not viewers yet, but soon to come.
Hopefully.
Soon to come.
Yeah.
If I don't scare them away, but I mean,
okay.
But when Israel, at this moment, occupies huge chunks of the West Bank, an embargo against Gaza. It's impossible to kind of negotiate a peace that way. We saw, you know, and the flotilla, from all I've read so far, was not bringing guns into Gaza, was not bringing missiles into Gaza. They were bringing medicine into Gaza. They were bringing construction materials into Gaza. They were bringing food into Gaza. They were bringing toys into Gaza. And what would Israel have lost if they had allowed this flotilla to dock and unload its cargo?
Right. Well, look, again, you bring it back to that one specific incident of yesterday. And, you know, I don't want to – to me, that isn't the broader point. But, you can make the opposite point to say, look, what would these flotilla people have lost if they would have brought the material to Ashdod and Israel could have inspected it before it went to Gaza? Because this was being sponsored by a group in Turkey that apparently had ties with Hamas. And Hamas, by the way, has diverted – construction materials for weapons purposes. And that's why you get all this issue of dual use and what, you know, I think they should streamline this blockade and make it more workable and, you know, things that, as you shouldn't say everything is forbidden and that which is permitted, but permit everything except the dual use items that are forbidden. It would just be streamlined. But the Israelis say they've had boats have come before. They brought the stuff to Gaza, to Ashdod. The Israelis inspected it, and they sent it on to Gaza. So if it is as innocent as you say, and you may be right, by the way, in the specific case, I'm not arguing with you, then I don't see why they didn't do it that way. But I still think the question is, where do we go from here in the broader picture? And where I would disagree with you, again, respectfully, is that I don't think you could say, well, there's no way to negotiate peace. I mean, George Mitchell, President Obama, these people are investing their time, and you know, Mitchell's out there every other week in these proximity talks and trying to get something going with the West Bank. I think he's actually onto something, which is to focus on the territory and the security of the West Bank. And I think that you could do with the West Bank leadership, and you could demonstrate that if you're willing to, you know, not fire rockets at people, but work with them, you know, you have something to gain. And the West Bank GNP is growing at about 10% a year. And I'm not saying that this solves our problems. It doesn't. But we need to see George Mitchell succeed, and we got to root for America's success in these proximity talks with President Obama. And I think there's a chance of that. But we won't have a chance if we tell people, you know, you could blow up people, you could fire rockets at them, but you're legit. That cuts the legs out from under the people who are willing to take it in the neck, so to speak, and work for a two-state solution. You know, we got to try to build the partnership here between the Palestinians and the Israelis and create a solution based on dignity for both sides.
We are also now, David Makovsky, we are now also joined by Adam Shapiro, one of the organizers of the flotilla, and his wife was on board. And Adam, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, Adam, talk about for a second before we come right back to David and kind of talk about what happened in the last day and a half and also what's about to happen and where we go from here. Talk about the origins of this flotilla and your role in it.
The origins of the flotilla go back to the very origins of the Free Gaza Movement when we launched our first ship to Gaza in August 2008. From the very beginning, we had always hoped and tried to organize to bring more and more partners and more ships involved. We never wanted to have just one or two ships. And so for the last 2 years or so, as we've been sending more and more missions, and I should note, the first five missions entered Gaza without interference from the Israeli army, although even at those times it threatened to open fire and to stop our ships at any cost. We did have five missions that reached Gaza unimpeded, and really, quite frankly, without any fanfare and without much media attention. And it only when Israel started stopping the missions that the media started paying more and more attention, and more people started paying attention to the blockade. Since July 2009, when we launched our previous mission, which was stopped and we were detained in an Israeli jail, we've worked hard to bring more partners involved, and that's what this flotilla was, and a coalition of groups with participants from over 40 countries, with cargo donated from quite a number of countries, and this kind of participation.
So let's again, with David Makovsky, I know you two have not met. David Makovsky is director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and co-author of Dennis Ross, the book Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction in the Middle East. And Adam Shapiro, of course, I just introduced as one of the organizers of the flotilla. And again, before we turn back to David, because I just want to get an update on what, from your perspective, what the latest news is, people in jail in Israel and who's been released and what you can tell us about what we've not heard maybe in the last 5 or 6 hours in the news.
Well, I don't know. I do know that more and more people are being released. I heard about 100 or so people were being sent out through Jordan earlier today. My wife has been released from jail. She reported to me that on her ship, Israeli commandos came on board. They did not meet any resistance from any of the passengers, but our passengers were indeed filming them. And as a result, people holding cameras and other people on board were physically abused by the soldiers, punching and kicking and whatnot. Later in detention, my wife also suffered being physically assaulted by soldiers and police. And then even as she was being escorted out of the jail to be released, an Israeli policeman elbowed her in the face. Our passengers on other ships apparently also suffered this kind of abuse and violence from Israeli soldiers.
So, and both of you, I'm just curious, what happens now? I mean, how many people do we know have been killed or injured in this process so far?
Oh, we don't know. I mean, Israel still refuses to release the names, release the nationalities of the people who have been killed and injured. The family members still don't know if their loved ones have been killed. It's as if Israel is trying to make these people disappear.
David?
Well, look, I'm not doubting Adam or his wife's commitment, to humanitarian assistance. I just wonder why, when the Israelis say they would have transferred everything that you had of all your ships through Ashdod to the Gazans, why that was not acceptable. They see
okay, David, I'll answer your question, and you should know this, right? You know that Israel has a list of items that are not allowed into Gaza, that the list of items that are allowed in is only 75 to 80 basic foodstuffs. There's no prefabricated housing allowed into Israel. This offer that Israel keeps saying that it made, it didn't make in the first place. And if you look at the statements of the foreign minister and the defense minister and the assistant or deputy foreign minister, they all said from the start that they would stop this mission by any means necessary, including lethal force. So we shouldn't reproduce Israeli propaganda. We should deal with the facts. The facts are that items are not allowed into Gaza, and there was no offer made to bring the items into Gaza.
David?
Well, look, my understanding from the quote of this spokeswoman of the Free Gaza Movement, which said, we're not here for humanitarian assistance. We're here to break a blockade. And, I mean, I think if the issue is the assistance itself, I think there's got to be a way around it. If you say the Israelis will say they'll do it and won't do it, why not hold them to it and say, here, you made a commitment publicly. This didn't get in.
Okay, here's why. Because sitting in Jordan now are millions of dollars.
Well, one at a time.
One at a time. This is bogus propaganda. Sitting in Jordan now, millions of dollars of items donated for Gaza that Israel has told countries around the world that it will allow into Gaza, and it doesn't. We don't need more proof that the blockade exists. We don't need more proof that Israel is not, that there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, that Israel is responsible for this crisis, and that the blockade itself is illegal according to international law. It forms a policy of collective punishment, as Israel is the occupying power of Gaza. These are facts. This is documented in the Goldstone Report. This is documented by other countries and international aid organizations. Let's deal with the facts. Let's deal with what really is happening on the ground, and let's not hypothesize about why not give Israel a chance to let in humanitarian aid.
And Adam,
aid is piled up around the world, around the borders of Israel, and it refuses to let it in.
And let me let David finish your thought. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I like the approach, which let's follow the facts. I mean, that's usually my approach too. And there was a piece in the Financial Times on May 24th. You can look it up online. Tobias Buck reporting out of Rafah saying the stores are overflowing. And that there's no shortage of food in Gaza at all. So, I mean, there's an impression created.
Let me let David finish the thought. You'll come right in. David, finish your thought.
Are you saying they're near starvation?
No, I'm not saying they're near starvation. But why? Because of the tunnels. It's not because of Israel. It's because Gazans have figured out how to break the blockade with the tunnels. And if Israel was really concerned about security and weapons and all these things, it's not from the ships. They should be worried about the tunnels. They know where the tunnels are. Anybody could go visit them. Anybody could pick them out. You can find them on satellite planes or the drones that Israel uses over Gaza all the time. They know where they are. They're not destroying them. There's a business going on. The only way Gazans are surviving today is because of the tunnels, not because of Israel.
Let me ask you both this question, though. It seems to me that we're going to open the phones and get a few callers in here before the end of the hour. It seems to me that where we are now is that there's an international movement that seems to be wrapping itself around the Palestinian cause. One of the people we talked to earlier today represents a kind of a new wrinkle in that in America, to the Reverend Heber Brown, an African-American Baptist minister who is here in Baltimore, with a group of other ministers visiting Ramallah and visiting Jerusalem and visiting Tel Aviv and Hebron. The tension around the Israeli-Palestinian issues question, I think, is taking on, is moving into kind of new uncharted territory. And I wonder where you both think this is going to go in the next few months. I really do think this is a kind of twist, no matter which side of the fence you live on, that we haven't seen before, that I think that is going to change the nature of the dialogue and discussion that may be kind of extra national in terms of what, no matter what the U.S. or anybody else does in the peace process? Let me start with David and go to Adam.
Well, I just feel that we have to be on the side of President Obama and George Mitchell. We launched these proximity talks, you know, so we don't want to maintain the status quo. We want a two-state solution that gives dignity to both sides. And I think that is best done through the peace table. And I'm glad the United States and President Obama prioritized this issue. And I think that's where American focus is. And it would be, you know, it would be sad for me if, because of things in Gaza, the peace talks now, you know, the Palestinian Authority, because they don't want to be outflanked by Hamas, you know, they decide they withdraw from these talks. We should keep our focus on the talks. And I'll, you know, and I, well, you know, I'll stop there.
Okay. Adam?
I'm not really quite sure what talks that David is referring to. There's been reports coming out that even George Mitchell is frustrated because really nothing is happening with these things. But regardless of that, what we are seeing is a global movement now tired of the situation where Palestinians are continually facing their rights abused, where they're frustrated in their any attempts to self-determination and to achieve their rights. And I think even in the United States, we're starting to see a movement. And I think, you know, the second phase of what is becoming an increasingly internationalized effort to achieve Palestinian rights. We saw the first phase in the early 2000s. The International Solidarity Movement was a big part of getting people to Palestine to see what was happening on the ground, to participate with Palestinians in the nonviolent movement. We're now seeing the second phase ramping up, including the the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which includes a cultural boycott of Israel. And we're seeing results. And Israel doesn't know what to do with those results. And, you know, now Israel has a very right-wing government, a government that is even extremist by most measures. Even by Israeli standards, it's extremist. And like any right-wing extremist government, when it faces a difficult situation, and this is not specific to Israel, and when it doesn't know what to do, it reaches for the only thing it knows how to do well, which is force, which is blunt, which is brutal, and which, you know, it will use.
I wonder, I mean, when people look at the videos of what happened on the boat, and I've been kind of watching as many as I can see at the moment, and they come from all over. I mean, when you talk a minute ago, Adam, about nonviolence, I mean, clearly from what it appears is that that when the last boat was boarded by the Israeli armed forces, it was not nonviolent resistance.
The live feed that came from our ship on satellite that was broadcast across the internet and across channels throughout the region and even internationally, some picked it up, showed from the beginning what happened. What happened was Israeli soldiers came down off of helicopters firing sound grenades, tear gas, and live ammunition at the passengers. And it's only after, and this is, you know, was recorded live. I mean, it was available for anybody. The Al Jazeera journalists have reported it. Other journalists have reported it, that as Israeli soldiers came down, they opened fire on the passengers first, and it's only after one person, at least one person, was killed and many injured, that some of the passengers took up, you know, these iron bars or whatever and started trying to protect themselves. And yes, it meant striking at the Israelis because the Israelis were firing at them. Now, according to international law and the law of the seas, when a ship that is perfectly legal where it was in international waters is besieged, the people on board have a right to protect themselves, to self-defense. And so I'm not really sure why there's all this focus on, you know, that anybody would try to defend themselves against commandos, with elite commandos, with armed with machine guns who've already opened fire and killed people on a ship. Why that's not considered violent. I'm not sure why there isn't any focus on that. And instead, there's focus on the fact that some of these people, you know, picked up a couple of clubs and were hitting Israeli soldiers.
Dave and Adam,
why didn't the Israeli reports say they came down firing paintball?
Are you kidding me, David? Are you telling me that Israel launched a multi-million-dollar operation with 1,000 troops, helicopters, airplanes, and warships, and it's elite commandos? All they had were paintballs?
Well,
folks, on radio, it's really hard to talk over because people can understand what's going on. Let me let David respond what you're saying, Adam. David?
To suggest that they had paint guns. Are you kidding me?
I'm telling you, that's what they are saying. They say they only used the guns after they were hit with clubs and knives and
I'm asking you a simple question. Does it make sense to you that they would come on board this ship after the Israeli defense minister said that they would use all means necessary to stop these ships, that they would come on with paintballs? Are you kidding me?
I'm not saying they didn't have other means, but they clearly didn't want to use it.
I'm just asking you, by the way, the
defense minister, you call the whole Israeli government extreme. Defense Minister Ehud Barak of the Liberal Labor Party that tried to make peace in the year 2000, I don't think he would agree with your characterization. Why not use that same energy to demonstrate against Hamas and peace with Israel? Why do it this way?
Hamas has offered to accept the 67 borders, UN resolutions, all of them. Israel is negotiating with Hamas over the release of Gilad Shalit. Israel has negotiated in the past with Hamas over the rockets. Why isn't it willing to sit down and talk peace with Hamas?
I mean, let me test this question before we run out of time here. I mean, Israel has already said today, just a little bit ago, that they were deporting all the activists seized in the flotilla, even the ones they threatened to prosecute. 680 activists are going to be sent out of the country. But tomorrow, approaching that same place, will be another ship.
No, I'm sorry. That's not correct.
Is that saying, Adam, you're saying that's not correct?
That's not correct. The ship will not be arriving tomorrow. We are strategizing on how best to send the ship. We actually now have new offers of potentially more boats to join the ship. So it will not be arriving. It's not on its way to Gaza at this point.
Okay. This is the ship that was from Ireland originally?
Yes.
But that means the flotilla from your work is going to continue?
Oh, absolutely. There will be further efforts to break the blockade. The blockade is teetering. The international community is calling on, is starting to speak up, reiterating its calls. David wanted to follow President Obama. Obama called for ending the blockade, lifting the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And where's Israel's response to that? It did not change one iota of its policy in response to President Obama.
David, and let me ask David this question before we run out of time here. I mean, if this flotilla keeps moving towards Gaza all the time, what do you think is going to happen in terms of Israeli policy and Israeli reaction if it becomes like an increasingly nonviolent movement of ships floating into Gaza? What do you think will happen?
Look, before Adam joined the conversation, I said to you, I didn't know Adam was joining then, but I said then at the start, and I'll say it now, which is that I am not a status quo person on the blockade. I feel it should be recalibrated in a way that these dual-use items, which Hamas, has diverted a lot of these materials for its own weapons, that they would revisit this list in a way, instead of saying everything is forbidden except that which is permitted, it should be everything is permitted except that which is forbidden. That's a lot of dual-use items in between. And I think that would be a way of solving both his concerns and my concerns. I just think that Adam lets the Hamas on the loose, lets them off the hook. I saw Khaled Mashal on Charlie Rose on PBS last week, and Charlie Rose kept pressing him and saying, if they accept the 67 resolution and the UN resolutions, will that be okay for you? And he said no. He said they have to agree to allow the right of return of millions of Palestinians, and then every single Palestinian in the world has to have a referendum, and then we'll see. Well, that's not.
Adam, we have 30 seconds for you to wrap up.
I mean, okay, fine. Hamas says that at this point, but, the process of negotiations, people move from their positions. If Hamas is willing to accept in principle, and I'm not defending Hamas, I don't want to see Hamas in power. I don't want to see Fatah in power. I don't want to see any of these factions in power, okay? So that's my position on this. But you know what? That's who the Palestinian people elected, I say, unfortunately, because I don't think they should elect any of these crooked leaders. But that's who they elected. And why isn't Israel dealing with them when they've been willing to deal with them on everything else?
Adam Shapiro and David Makowski, thank you so much for both joining us. And we look forward to talking to you both again very soon. And thanks for your talking with our listeners.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to have you both on.
All the best.
We'll be right back. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. When we come back, we'll be talking about violence in Baltimore with Love Hands Across Baltimore, and then talk with Woody Curry. Stay with us.